Hello, you're listening to a special podcast from the annual convention of the Federation of Atheist, Humanist, and Secularist Student Societies. In this series of podcasts, you'll hear from the speakers at the conference. This podcast is of writer, scientist, and new president of the British Humanist Association, Jim Al-Khalili. The Pod Delusion is a weekly news magazine program about interesting things, from science to culture to politics, all from a skeptical rationalist point of view. You can find out more at poddelusion.co.uk. Now here's AHS President Jess Vautier introducing the speaker.
Right, personally I can't wait to hear the talk from our next speaker, who is a writer and broadcaster, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the University of Surrey. He also presents the Life Scientific on Radio 4, and he is the current BHA President. And this is actually going to be his first appearance as such. So if you'd like to put your hands together for Professor Jim Al-Khalili.
Good afternoon, everyone. Okay, so my first appearance. I should look very nervous and, well, you know, this is a responsible job. I brought my glasses up with me. I'm hoping I don't have to squint to read, otherwise I'll be pulling them down to the bottom of my nose and looking over them at you in a schoolmasterly sort of way. So, yes, I took over as president of the British Humanist Association in New Year, and this is my first official engagement. So, in a way, I'm sort of thinking I'm going to be saying stuff which, for many who have been long-standing humanists, atheists, had debates about secularism versus religion for many years, I hope I won't be saying things that are too obvious, that are sort of somewhat naive. But certainly I'm very excited with this role, and I want to take this opportunity to tell you a little bit about who I am, what I believe, what I stand for, and what I hope I can personally achieve and what I can maybe help encourage through my tenancy as president. First and foremost, I'm a scientist. Now, for many people would know me as a broadcaster, as a writer, but my day job, as my wife always reminds me, is as an academic. I shouldn't lose sight of that, so I'm still involved in teaching and research and doing all the jobs that an academic professor would do in a university. As a scientist, I view the world around me in a way that a scientist does. I'm curious about the universe. I'm curious about our place in the universe. I guess sometimes to the point of obsession. That's what defines me as a scientist. I want answers. Now, along with that come other attitudes and views that I also hold, such as a rationalist conviction that our universe is understandable, that mysteries are only mysteries because we've yet to figure them out. Almost always, there's a simple and logical example, answer. So sometimes in my area of theoretical physics, logic can be sort of somewhat stretched, and many ideas in modern physics are rather counterintuitive. Nevertheless, there is no room, and hasn't been throughout my career, the last 30 or so years as a scientist, there's been no room for a supernatural divine being that sort of fills in the blanks, occupies the gaps in my understanding. In my view, we'll get there. We don't have all the answers about the workings of nature and the laws of physics and chemistry and how the universe evolves. But we will fill in the gaps with objective scientific truths, answers that are not subject to cultural or historic whims or personal biases, but empirically testable and reproducible truths. We won't ever reach a full picture, get a complete answer, but science allows us to get ever closer to that. I'm also, I like to think, a decent bloke. Like the vast majority, I think, of fellow human beings, I subconsciously live by the adage that one should only do unto others what one would hope others would do unto oneself. So that means human traits and attributes like empathy, tolerance, kindness. It's only in recent years, so I guess for many of you who are still students, you have a huge head start on me if you're already starting to think along humanist lines. It's only in recent years that I came to appreciate that these attributes, this worldview that I hold, defines me as a humanist. In many ways, my life is uncomplicated. It's an undemanding lifestyle with the people I mix with. My friends, my colleagues, in my liberal, generally well-educated and enlightened little world, it's sometimes easy to be complacent, even lazy in this belief and this attitude-affirming bubble that I inhabit, a humanist bubble. I'm surrounded by like-minded people. On the whole, the 30-plus thousand people who follow me on Twitter presumably hold similar views to me. I mean, that's why they follow me on Twitter. And this reinforces the illusion that the rest of the world agrees with me. It's very comforting. Here I am today, I would anticipate, I expect, preaching to the converted. I'm not going to get booed, I suspect, from what I'm going to be saying. So it's... Well, maybe I'll try and do my best. So it is scary sometimes when, you know, one steps outside this bubble and sees attitudes and beliefs and bigotry, not just right-wing creationists in the US, you know, but the rest of the world too. I've always, you know, really marveled at how someone like Richard Dawkins can go on an American radio show and have a debate with a right-wing Christian fundamentalist. You know, it's just, I cringe when I watch it and listen to it because I'm just full of admiration because I don't think I'd be able to do that. It takes courage. So another aspect of my atheism I probably should make clear. I am what some might refer to, presumably, as a critical or even derogatory label. I'm an accommodationist. By this I mean I'm tolerant of people with religious faith. And I want to lay out my arguments for this stance in the sense that I believe there is room for people with religious faith in the world. Do I think the world would be better without religion at all? Well, in a utopian sort of way, I guess, yes. It would be nice to live in a world in which nobody feels the need to believe in a supernatural, omnipotent creator. But firstly, this is simply not going to happen, not in my lifetime anyway. Secondly, I reckon the world would be a pretty boring place if we all believed the same thing. Of course, we look around the world today and at the many injustices carried out in the name of religion, the violent sectarian hatred between Shia and Sunni Muslims, the outdated views of the Christian church on women or contraception or gay rights, or even trivial things like a society that allows all religious denominations to be represented on Remembrance Day, apart from those who don't subscribe to a recognised religious faith. Or even bloody points of, was it thought of the day on Radio 4. You know, there are trivial things like that, and all the way, the scale all the way out to the extreme atrocities committed in the name of religion. But to hope for a world where some people can't have their own private belief in a particular worldview, whether it's a monotheistic god, whether it's UFOs, whether it's magic, would actually be a bland world to live in. I guess, in addition, my accommodationist stance is also born out of my respect for many good people who have religious faith, people who don't deserve the derision we might sometimes pour on them for holding such silly views. Why would I want to upset my devoutly Christian mother? I'm not going to change her mind after all. We must acknowledge that for many people, faith does provide comfort, social cohesion, a sense of belonging, hope. I don't need it, but it would be arrogant and silly of me to think that everyone would or should think the same way as me. One of the most important traits, after all, as far as I'm concerned, of being a humanist, is to have empathy. To place yourself in the shoes of the person with whom you don't agree. To see the world from their perspective. I mean, don't get me wrong, I am supremely confident in my atheism. I'm as agnostic about the existence of God, I think as Ricky Gervais once said, as I am about the existence of Father Christmas. And I'm pretty sure he's made up. So let me tell you a little bit about my background, about my journey, because I think it is important. For me, it's important in shaping who I am today. My father is a Muslim. He was born in Iraq, as I was. He came over to Britain in the 50s, where he met my English Christian mother. They married in 1960, moved back and settled in Iraq. My father was an electrical engineer, worked in the Iraqi Air Force. I was born in Baghdad. My mother being English, my mother tongue was English, so we spoke English at home. But I grew up in Iraq, and I went to school there until the age of 16. So outside the house, I spoke Arabic. Officially, according to the laws of the land, I was a Muslim, because my father, you follow the religion of your father. But I was brought up in a household which wasn't sort of overly religious. I think it's very, very typical in a household where your parents sort of believe in God, you believe in God. For me, it was, you know, Allah is just the Arabic word for God. As far as I was concerned, these are, they're two different pathways that have developed this mythology surrounding a belief in an Abrahamic, monotheistic God, that have slightly different rules, but obviously one is copied from the other. For me, there wasn't, the conflict that a lot of people have. Hang on, with the usual argument, how can you all be right? If you have different takes on religion, for me, there wasn't an issue, and so. I think there are three kinds of atheists. There's the type that you grow up in a house in a family that's already not religious, and so for you it's just silly to hold any other kind of view. You've always not had a religious faith. Then there are those who rebel against the religion of their parents or their social group, and it's quite a sort of a sharp, sudden upheaval in discovering that, hey, I don't need to believe in God. And then there's the third type, like me, who just gradually drift away and think, I don't need this. It's not important. And I think part of it for me has been my scientific training. I think that has helped cement my view. Today, my mother is still, she's devoutly religious. She goes to church every Sunday, an evangelical Christian. She is one of the few people in her church who's not a creationist. She's very proud of this, but I think feels somewhat outnumbered in having to argue that case amongst the congregation in the church. But she's sort of proud of it when she sort of tells us, her family, about it. She respects my atheism. I respect her religion. And we typically, the Al-Khalilis do have the usual sort of Christmas theological, political type debates over Christmas. It's quite interesting. For us, it's broader because of my father, who's a lapsed Shia Muslim, although he does come from a very religious background. He was born in the Iraqi city of Najaf, which is one of the holiest cities in Shia Islam. Najaf and Karbala are the two cities in Iraq, which is one of the four countries in the world where the Shia sect is the majority. Iraq, Iran, Lebanon and Bahrain, I think. Everywhere else, the Sunnis are the majority. So my father comes from this very devoutly religious background. And indeed, many of his relatives and the Al-Khalilis, like many other Iraqis, had to leave the country when Saddam came to power. And so my parents, whenever they go traveling around the world, they're always staying with cousins. It's always cousins. It might be second or third cousins twice removed, but they're all Al-Khalilis, they're all cousins. And many of them are very devoutly religious, to the point that, the women, they could be my father's cousins or nieces or great nieces, will not shake hands with him because that's, not allowed, or will cover up when he walks into the room. My father's 81 and he gets very, very cross When he walks in, he said, why? Why are you covering? Do you think that I'm such a sex maniac that I'm going to, you know, jump on you and molest you? You know, he doesn't want to be so rude as to say, do you think you're so beautiful that no man can resist you? Because that will be that. You know, but he does get frustrated because he knows that his generation of al-Khalilis and many other women in Iraq fought very hard for the right not to wear a headscarf or hijab or the abaya, the black veil, all sort of body covering cloak that women wear in the more religious parts of Iraq. And yet their daughters are now moving back to it. So it frustrates him. And I think that frustration has helped move him away from religion. So he doesn't say too much in front of my mother, but in private to me, very silly, very silly. So we have interesting debates and discussions at home. It's because of my background and my familiarity growing up in a Muslim culture and ways of thinking that I have such a problem with so many attitudes in the Muslim world and why I'm in such admiration of people like Alam Shahar, who has had the courage to write such a wonderful book, the Young Atheist Handbook. I mean, a show of hands, how many people here come from a Muslim background? One, two. Right, just two of you. And you're hiding. or you're just having a nap. You know, I think, in a sense, that's my point. It's easier to embrace sort of a secular, rationalist, humanist worldview coming from an enlightened C of E culture background. And certainly when it comes up as a conflict between science and religion, the Islamic world is centuries behind the West. I recently wrote a book on the history of Arabic science called Pathfinders, and in it I stress the point that 1,000 years ago in Baghdad of the Abbasid dynasty, only a century or two after Islam, in sort of around about the ninth century, it was a wonderful golden age of enlightenment, and there was a tolerance of science and free thinking, as opposed to the sort of thinking that I find so often in the Muslim world today, which is, well, let me check if it's okay, if the Quran tells me it's okay to think that way. One of the examples, and I think there's a wonderful article in this month's copy of New Humanist magazine by Alam Shahar on the way the Muslim world views evolution. The debate on evolution, even though, you know, we're aware of what sometimes might seem a growing number of fundamentalist creationists in the Western world, in Europe and America, but the debate about evolution versus creationism took place 150 years ago. We are still debating it and arguing it now, yes, but there's space allowed for even for people with firmly held religious beliefs to, at the same time, without any issue, embrace Darwinian evolution. That hasn't happened in the Muslim world yet. That argument, that dialogue, is only just now beginning to emerge from a few courageous souls, because you do have to have courage to even engage in that sort of debate. As a scientist, I usually the creationist argument, this is a slight aside, but just worth sort of interesting to mention that usually the scientific stance against creationism is argued from a biological perspective. That, you know, we see the evidence all around us that evolution is true and that evolution requires millions, billions of years. And so, obviously, the creationist idea of the world being created 6,000 years ago must be nonsense. But actually, I take a stance typically from a sort of a geological or astronomical, or even, I mean, my specialist area is nuclear physics. So just from a nuclear physicist perspective, there are very strong arguments to counter creationism. And sometimes, for me, because that's more familiar to me, they are even more powerful than the argument of Darwinian natural selection, because they're easier to defend. carbon dating, the half-life of uranium. I mean, Lord Rutherford, over 100 years ago, was famous for carrying a lump of rock in his pocket, which had traces of uranium in it. And he understood that uranium is radioactive. He was one of the founders of the field of radioactivity. He understood that uranium emits alpha particles. And alpha particles are just the nuclei of helium atoms. And so when these alpha particles come out of the uranium, they get trapped in the pores in the rock, and they capture a couple of electrons, and they turn into neutral helium atoms. So he knew that by measuring the traces of helium in a rock, he could determine how long that uranium had been there, because he knew what the half-life of uranium was. The half-life of uranium is 4.5 billion years. So if you have a lump of pure uranium of 1 kilogram, in 4.5 billion years, that will have decayed away, leaving 0.5 kilogram. A further 4.5 billion years, you'd have 0.25 kilogram, and so on. But you don't need a kilogram of uranium to work out the half-life. And so he knew from how much helium had accumulated in this rock and how much uranium was in there, how long it had been decaying. And he used that rock to argue the case for the age of the Earth. Now, he got the number wrong. I think he had an estimate of hundreds of millions of years, whereas we know you want to be multiplying that by another 10, so it's 4 or 5 billion years. But nevertheless, for me, those are the sorts of arguments that are much more powerful. When a creationist says, yes, but there are issues with evolution. How can you say this and how can you say that and how can you be sure? And God just put the fossils in the ground to test our faith. I say, well, look, okay, explain to me the half-life of uranium. We have nuclear power, for goodness sakes. We understand how atomic nuclei work. Where is the flaw in my thinking? I think if all this was put there by God to test our faith, then we would cease to live in a rational world. Nothing we see would need to make sense. If we find something we can't explain or can't quite fit into our worldview, it becomes magic, just down to the divine whim of a creator, who also, for some reason I could never fathom as a child, apparently was desperate for our approval and loyalty. But how do we draw the line between something we can explain through science, through rational, logical thinking in our universe, and something we can't, and therefore just give up and say, I'm not even going to try, that is the domain of the Creator? Okay, having got that off my chest, I'd like to take a step back and ask an important question. Something that I think led me in the last few years to wanting to be more involved in humanism. Are science and religion compatible? Well, it depends on how you define them and who you are. Can a biologist be a creationist? Of course not. The central idea of biology is that Darwinian natural selection is correct. You can't simultaneously believe that evolution is correct and believe the world was created in 4004 BC on a Thursday morning at 11 o'clock. But if you ask me, can a string theorist be a creationist? In principle, I'd say, I guess, yes. I'd be disappointed that someone as bright enough to understand string theory could believe in creationism, but on a practical level, unless string theory makes some prediction about the age of the universe, which I don't believe it does, then the two need not conflict with each other. And of course, here I've chosen a rather extreme example religious belief, and I guess in a way it's not very fair to pick on creationism all the time. One of the most respected astrophysicists in the world today, Dame Jocelyn Bell Burnell. This is the woman who, in the mid-60s, discovered pulsars. Now, pulsars are what we now call neutron stars. A star, when it runs out of its nuclear fuel and collapses under its own weight, then explodes as a supernova, sheds a lot of its stardust into space, and the remaining core collapses down to a very dense ball, and which spins around. And Jocelyn Bell Burnell was still a PhD student when she discovered pulsars for the first time, and famously was passed up on a Nobel Prize. The Nobel Prize was given to her supervisor, But not to her, because she was just a PhD student, and I suspect also because she was a woman. Just one of those stories that you see time and time again in science where women have been passed up for Nobel Prize. Lisa Meitner for the discovery of fission is another example. Nevertheless, Jocelyn Bell has been a wonderful advocate for science. She's gone on to great things. She's Dame Jocelyn Bell by now. She's a fellow of the Royal Society. She was president of the Institute of Physics. She's also a Quaker, and quite a devout Quaker. Now, you might argue that, you know, being a Quaker is a rather benign, gentle, non-intrusive sort of religious faith. True, that she has a religious faith. Has her faith made her any less of a scientist? I don't believe it has. And of course, the engineer, or the mathematician, or the inorganic chemist, or the laser physicist can all get on with their scientific work, even if it's fundamental scientific research, and not have it be compromised by the fact that they might pray, or go to the synagogue, or go to the church, or refuse to eat pork or beef. Of course, ultimately, a belief in scientific truth is to subscribe to the worldview that the universe is comprehensible through deep underlying laws of nature, often mathematical laws, principles that follow from logic and which are comprehensible, on the whole, by the human mind. Cause and effect, logical, rational explanations, causality. If I'm pushed, then, to ask whether all that sits comfortably with a belief that there is a supernatural being that requires no explanation, then, of course, I'd have to say no. But the issue here is not that I would wish to banish any such double thinking from everyone, but rather that, and you know, many intelligent people of faith see this as clearly as I do, where an issue of faith butts up to and conflicts with science, and here I would say scientific truth, then religious faith has to give way. After all, this has been happening constantly for the last half a millennium, even if the Catholic Church was rather slow in accepting the heliocentric model of Copernicus and Galileo. As we learn more and more about the universe and the workings of nature, so those who follow the teachings of a religious faith must revise their views. Because not to means they'll be left behind. Scientific discoveries aren't fashion. They're not just the current way of thinking. They may be wrong, of course. They may almost certainly not be the whole picture. But we arrive at a scientific understanding of the universe and our place in it by learning the language of nature, the laws of physics and chemistry, by examining hypotheses, asking others to test them and reproduce our empirical results, by constantly subjecting our theories to the scrutiny of others, testing them to destruction, we say. This is the opposite of blind faith. Of course, okay, even that's not fair. Not everyone with a religious faith follows it blindly. To think that is naive and insulting to the many people who constantly do question their faith. So as an atheist, I find that I choose my battles carefully. If you're a creationist, or you believe that quantum mechanics and relativity are written completely in the Quran, as I often get emails telling me about, or that astrology, or homeopathy, or wearing copper bracelets, or Reiki healing, or any of that is actually true and actually works, then bring it on. These are irrational views that go against science, and I will defend science in face of them. But if you have a deeply held conviction that there is something out there of some deeper significance, some presence or force or spiritual meaning to your life that's very important to you, then who the hell am I to try and convince you otherwise if you don't try and impose that view on me? In any case, it would be futile to even try. I'm excited to be part of the BHA, getting the message across that we represent a broad cross-section of society in this country. We are not just a quaint sect. A quaint, that's a Freudian slip, a quaint sect who hold secular weddings and funerals. My firm conviction is that actually more than half this country are humanists and probably agree with what we stand for. the fact that there can be different views within humanism, I think, is healthy. Because we're not a cult or following some party line. I remember as a student in the early to mid-80s, being a very staunch socialist and following sort of the Labour Party line. This was during the miners' strike and CND marches and so on. And I remember I watched things like Question Time and take notes. Because I would say, okay, so what is my view on such and such? What is the Labour Party view? Therefore that is my view. You know, I wouldn't think for myself because I felt somehow to deviate from that would mean I was not a good socialist. It shouldn't be that way. Richard Dawkins has been tremendously important in making atheism respectable. Many religious people see him as being too obdurate, too confrontational, and, you know, I guess maybe so. But what a tremendously important and very often courageous stance he's taken. His version of uncompromising atheism has expanded the space into which atheists and even agnostics can occupy. 10 or 20 years ago, we were regarded by many people who hadn't given much thought to their belief system, I guess, as an extremist, hardline group of people who seemed no different in their single-minded evangelism to any of the fundamental religions. Now, it's not in the least bit shocking to bring up one's atheism in polite conversation today. Maybe that's just in the bubble that I live in, but I think things are changing very fast. It shouldn't be that atheists, humanists, secularists are those who have to somehow extract themselves from society's default position of theism. We are the default. Before the Enlightenment, before we began to understand that our universe and our place in it was rational and understandable according to the logical laws of science, we used faith in a supernatural deity as a comforting replacement for enlightened scientific rationalism. That is no longer necessary. Today, God is a placebo. Does that mean that in the 21st century, having a religion is wrong or bad? Well, it can be. But for millions, indeed billions of people around the world, and I've mentioned this before, it's a hugely important comfort. It's a cultural glue. It's a unifying communal set of guiding principles and ideals instructing people how to lead their lives. And actually, it often does make people feel a lot better. But here's what is, for me, the crucial issue. You don't need God to be good. Having faith in God is fine if that is something that is important to you, and if you truly believe this as some ontological truth, then it's rather pointless having theological debate, has been obvious for millennia. But don't you dare tell me that organized religion is the only means through which you can lead a good life. That attitude that religious faith is the only means of providing a moral compass, and that without it, and this is something I've discussed with the chief rabbi recently, that somehow without it, society would dissolve into some sort of hedonistic, anarchic, amoral, self-gratifying decadence, is not only arrogant rubbish, but groundless intellectual laziness. Living in a country with secular laws means creating a level playing field for everyone. Leading a life based on humanist ideals of fairness, empathy, tolerance, and kindness. Then, and only then, can those with a religious faith build on top of this if they so wish. I'd argue, therefore, that in some sense, we can now afford to be less strident, more tolerant of those with religious faith. Not because I'm less committed or because I have less conviction than others, but precisely because I believe we are winning the arguments. I don't believe we have to defend our atheism any longer. If any defending of views is required, then let the onus be on those of faith who have to do it. Our society is no longer really a religious one that a minority of us have opted out of as some sort of extremist group. We are, I believe, the mainstream. But it should also be that we are tolerant, inclusive, and happy with those who would not wish to give up their religious faith. Of course, we are lucky here in Britain, or in Northwest Europe, because we don't live in very religious societies, like, to pick countries out of the air, Iran and America. Of course, I don't mean in the way the two states are run. At least in the US, there is a constitution which attempts to ensure, thanks to people like Thomas Jefferson, that religion and state are separate. Something we don't even have in the UK, of course. Whereas in Iran, the laws are determined by the religious leaders. But actually, and I know this firsthand from having visited Iran, from having family and friends who live in Iran, that when it comes to the wider society, actually it's not quite clear that Iranian people are more religious than American people. Don't get the impression that I'm arguing for complacency, or that when I say we're winning the argument, that the argument is won. Far from it. It's just that now we're in a position to be able to change attitudes, to correct unfair and discriminatory laws to make for a fairer society, living in a secular state, where religion doesn't give one group an advantage or special privileges. We haven't been able to fight that battle very easily up until, I guess, just a few years ago. While I might now be in a position where my voice is heard, and of course with my new role as president of the British Humanist Association, come obligations and responsibilities. But my views are becoming known. Well, you know, Jamal Khalili would say that, wouldn't he? You know, I joined the ranks of Richard Dawkins and Peter Atkins and Polly Toynbee and A.C. Grayling and Robin Ince, you know, in being an outspoken atheist, even maybe if my approach is a little different. But I wasn't active. I wasn't speaking out like this 20 or 30 years ago. Here is where, I guess, you as students are in a very different position, because you're the ones who can make the real difference. It's you who have to convince wider society that being a humanist, not having a religious belief, doesn't make you an extremist. It doesn't make you a fanatic or radical. You're the ones who have to change society. The BHA currently has a membership of near on 30,000 people. 30,000. Why is that? Why isn't it 30 million in the UK? That's how many humanists I think there are. Somewhat paradoxically, it would be nice to think that one day it will come a time when, not when there is no religion, but when there is no need for a British Humanist Association, because most of us will be humanists already. Thank you very much. Thank you. I didn't need my glasses. I'm not sure whether, since I only arrived lunchtime, I'm not sure whether the convention is that I take questions or whether I move over, because I guess Polly will be speaking in a few minutes. But I'm. Is the convention to take questions? Yes, good. There you go. You've decided, sir. Go ahead. Jefferson, yeah. Yes, yes. You're right. Yes, I mean that is a problem. Yeah, and certainly in the Muslim world, for many people, science is regarded as a Western atheist construct. Absolutely, absolutely. Have had the Enlightenment. Absolutely. Yes, that's right. Oh, we talk about the Enlightenment when we refer to the European Enlightenment. We refer to the Renaissance in Europe. But every culture, every civilization has had its golden age, which, you know, cultures, civilizations rise and fall. I mean, that was, I guess, the purpose of writing my book about Arabic science, that, you know, there was a time when we talk about the Dark Ages. Well, that was only Western Europe. That wasn't the rest of the world. That was 1,000 years ago, at a time when the Islamic Empire, China, India, the Americas, there were wonderful, thriving civilizations. Even in the... I mean, I grew up and I went to school in Iraq, and I don't learn about the great scholars of medieval Islam. I don't learn about, you know, Avicenna and Averroes and Ibn al-Haytham, the great physicist who wrote his book of optics. You know, I didn't learn about Khwarizmi, inventing algebra. You learn a bit about the ancient Greeks, but essentially science is taught, even in other parts of the world, from a Eurocentric perspective. And you're right, it's re-educating people, getting other people in other parts of the world, other cultures and civilizations, to take a pride in their own heritage, to show that their ancestors also contributed to the body of knowledge that we have as humanity. It wasn't just all invented in Europe and then imposed on them from outside. So it is re-educating, and that has to come, I guess, from within. It can't be, you can't impose these Eurocentric views and then impose on top of that the view that the world isn't Eurocentric. It's all got to grow up from within those cultures themselves. Well, it was just the one question then. Clearly, that was just... Good. Thank you very much. Thank you.
That's it. If you'd like to find out more about the Poddelusion and listen to the other speakers from the AHS convention or our regular weekly show, just head over to poddelusion.co.uk. Thanks for listening.